I'm Scott Lamar. The top stories of 2019 on Smart Talk series continues today with one of the most significant anniversaries of the year. 40 years ago, on March 28, 1979, the Unit 2 reactor at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant partially melted. One person called the TMI accident the most historic event in central Pennsylvania since the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863. TMI was one of those moments in the region's history that left everyone remembering where they were and what they were doing. WITF and Smart Talk, along with media partners PA Post and Penn Live, produced dozens of programs and stories about the 1979 accident. What you'll hear today is from Smart Talk programs that examine several aspects of the Three Mile Island accident. Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 40 years ago today, the eyes of the world were on central Pennsylvania as the Unit 2 reactor at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant was melting. No one knew it at the time. In fact, much of the information we had at the time was wrong or just someone's guess. It was the nation's worst commercial nuclear accident, and still is. Thousands left the area, not knowing whether they would be able to return to their homes. There was confusion and a lack of communication. About a dozen studies indicated that the radiation released from TMI had no negative health effects. Research at Penn State Hershey in 2017 seemed to contradict those findings, and many still believe TMI led to their cancer or other health problems. There's a lot to discuss today. Joining us in this first portion of today's program is Bill Dornsife. In 1979, Bill Dornsife was the director of the Pennsylvania Bureau of Radiation Protection. As a trained nuclear engineer, Bill was responsible for all coordination between the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He was one of the first responders to the accident at Three Mile Island. Bill Dornsife, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
Bill Dornsife, what were you doing 40 years ago today, right at this very moment?
Well, I actually was the first one to call into the plant the morning of the accident. Under our emergency plan, when an emergency was declared by the plant, they called the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, and they in turn called our bureau, and I was the designee to call into the plant. Well, I got a hold of somebody in the control room and started asking questions.
Okay, before you do that, before you describe that, how were you told? How did you find out that there had been an incident, an unusual event, as it was referred to, at TMI?
Well, it was called a site emergency, was mm-hmm. what it was called. Mm-hmm. Well, PEMA said, hey, the plant has declared a site emergency. You know, call them up and find out what's going on.
So you did that. What happened?
Okay. Well, I started asking a series of questions, and it was pretty obvious that at that point they really weren't sure what happened and, you know, what they were going to do to fix the problem. In the middle of that conversation, I heard in the background, "Now evacuate the fuel handling on auxiliary building." And I said to myself, "Oh my God." And the guy I was talking to hung up.
Hung up on you.
Yeah, he just said, "I got to go now," and hung up. And I said to myself, "My God, this must be the biggie." And I then went into the office where we opened an open line with the plant. But unfortunately, when the hordes from Washington descended on us to do interviews of what our recollections were from what had happened, I made the mistake of saying that my thought was, this is the biggie. Well, it became the chapter of the first, a title of a chapter of the first NRC report that came out. So you better watch what you say.
Well, why do you say unfortunately? I mean, it was the biggie.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It sounded silly to me.
So we're going to have, and hopefully we're going to have something here a little bit later where we can hear a description of what happened that morning that caused the accident. But with your background as a nuclear engineer, when you heard what was going on, when you went to the site, what did you think, what did everyone around you think had actually happened?
Well, it didn't really come out till much later that, you know, the loss of coolant accident, which what it was caused by a stuck open relief valve. That we didn't get that information probably until Wednesday afternoon. But you know, I think what really caused the core to be uncovered was the pressure and some other things that had happened. A valve was locked closed that was from the emergency feed water system, was supposed to keep water in the steam generator, and none got in, so it boiled dry and basically increased the severity of the transient. But the pressurizer level was, pressurizer is a tank on the system that controls pressure. The level kept going up unexpectedly because of the open valve on top. And the operators were trained to never let the pressurizer go solid, because if it did, they would lose pressure control. So the operators started throttling back and turning off some of the makeup pumps or the safety injection pumps that started automatically. If they would have kept their hands off the panel, nothing would have happened. No meltdown would have occurred.
So when we describe what caused the accident as a combination of design flaw, that the plant itself had a design flaw, what was that design flaw? Okay, we heard about the stuck open valve, but was that the flaw?
Yeah, well, the initiator was probably not necessarily a flaw. One of the pumps feeding into the system that sends water to the pressure or the steam generator tripped, and that in turn caused the turbine pumps to trip. But you know, the stuck open relief valve, believe it or not, a similar plant about 3 months earlier had the identical problem, and they were able to identify it and recover from it without an issue. Unfortunately, at the time, there really was no effective way to exchange operational information between plants.
So tell me what's going on behind the scenes at this point from the state's point of view. I mean, when this first started 40 years ago, about 3:52 a.m. in the morning,
right,
March 28th, 1979, at first Metropolitan Edison, which operated the plant, owned by General Public Utilities. At first, it was a Med-Ed issue. Eventually, state is told about what's going on. You mentioned Washington, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Eventually, the White House is told what's going on. So here we are around 9:15 that morning, maybe a little bit later in the morning. What's going on behind the scenes after you get hung up on by someone at the plant?
Right. Well, like I said, I went into the office, and we immediately opened a line and kept the line open to the control room. Now, today there is a facility that has continuous open lines. That's one of the reasons for the facility. But then we had to actually use a commercial telephone. So we kept. The real major event that occurred that morning was the state decided to have a press conference, and I was told to go over and brief the lieutenant governor, who was the head of the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, as one of his collateral duties. So before I went over there, I talked to the plant manager, and of course learned that they had the stuck open relief valve and they weren't seeing any radiation releases. There could have been some primary to secondary leak through the steam generator that may have released some very small amounts of radioactive material that they weren't really detecting. So I went over there and spent a good hour briefing the lieutenant governor and
who's the head of PEMA.
Yes, and we then went into the press conference. And the statement was very simple. You know, Med-Ed has reported an incident at TMI, and everything seems to be under control, and there are no releases. Well, unfortunately, on the way over, I called back to the office, and by that time, about 10:30 or so, they were seeing releases. And of course, we sent out our monitoring teams once that occurred to do confirmatory monitoring. But, you know, as soon as the soon as the press started asking technical questions, and we were talking technical questions as such as, what is containment? Or what is a millirem? They threw me in front of the microphone, and I pretty much conducted the rest of the interview.
So you pretty much handled the first press conference from the state's perspective for the Three Mile Island accident.
Yes.
What was the sense you got? Because you said technical questions like, what is a containment building? That
right.
was one of the real problems
yep.
with information, especially from MedEd, is that there really weren't people who were schooled, trained in public relations, talking to the media, answering questions from the media. So it tended to get a little technical. And on the media's part, they knew nothing about
sure.
this. So what was your sense from that very first press conference?
Well, I knew it was going to be a long road, you know, because of the questions I was getting. I mean, I tried to, you know, when they'd say, what is that? I tried to explain as best I could, you know, what it really was. But I'm not sure whether they got it or not. But the questions were just coming fast and furious, as you can well imagine. You know, it was just, you know, like a typical press conference when there's a crisis. I didn't know who to look to take their question.
All right, so that was the first press conference, and at that point, the state is told that you found out that there are radiation releases, and you know, to this day, we're told a small amount of radiation that was released. But when did – and a lot of times, I guess I should back up a little bit, because when we talk about the Three Mile Island accident, everyone who was here tends to remember Wednesday the 28th is when the accident occurred. The first day, we don't know a whole lot, just trying to feel our way through it. Thursday, not a whole lot's happening. But Friday is really when things started to get bad, because there was the talk of a hydrogen bubble that was growing inside the containment building that could have exploded, and if exploded, could spew radiation everywhere. So those are the first 3 days. We go to Sunday when President Carter arrives on the scene. So that's just an overview of the 5 days up until then. So that first day in the afternoon, we've heard from Jack Irvine, who was the main spokesman for MedEd, was a vice president, again, not schooled in public relations, who said that we think this is a minor fuel failure, as he referred to it, and said, we think we'll be back online in just a few days.
Right.
You heard that statement. Did you agree?
Well, At the time, I had no idea, you know, what had really happened and how that the fuel. I don't think we even knew that there were higher temperatures in the fuel at that point. But it was pretty obvious that something had happened to the fuel, because there was massive amounts of fuel cladding failure, which allowed fission products, particularly xenon, which is an inert radioactive gas, to be released to the reactor coolant system. And of course, later that day, they had to release some xenon gas from the system to prevent the makeup pumps from tripping. Also, obviously, it was obvious that because of all the hydrogen in the system, that there was very high temperatures, because essentially the hydrogen is caused by steam interacting with the cladding. So the core had to be partially uncovered to get the steam to interact with the cladding.
But
the damage, the cladding is a zirconium rod that goes around the pellets,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they're put into a fuel assembly of about, I don't know, about 16 or so of these elements.
Talk more about the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. You're home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk on this, the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island, the nation's worst commercial nuclear accident, March 28th, 1979. Our guest today during this portion of the program is Bill Dornsife. In 1979, he was the director of Pennsylvania's Bureau of Radiation Protection, and he was behind the scenes, had a firsthand look at what was going on at TMI and from the state's perspective. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, Bill, so meltdown. We didn't find out until a few years later that there had been a partial meltdown. Actually, three quarters of the nuclear reactor, Unit 2, had been exposed. When was the first talk at all of a possible meltdown in those early days?
Well, I think most of the technical people, including me, didn't believe there was massive fuel melting like was discovered when they actually took pictures. I was extremely surprised that there was that much damage. And, you know, that little release, because, you know, they talk about a fuel meltdown causing real problems in terms of containing it. Basically, I think at the time, everybody believed there was fuel failure. Maybe some melting.
What does fuel failure mean? When I heard Irvine say that, it's like, okay, what does fuel failure mean?
Fuel failure, primarily in the simplest terms, is some rupture of the cladding that surrounds the pellets, allowing fission products, radioactive, you know, fission products to get out into the reactor coolant.
Fuel failure sounds like I'll be quite honest, it sounds like spin.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what it's called technically, you know, when the cladding fails.
Okay. All right, so we're at a point now where we're realizing that there's some potential danger. You mentioned the hordes from Washington.
Yes.
What did that add to it when the NRC is getting involved and people from Washington? I mean, because now we're talking about with a hydrogen bubble, we're talking about evacuation and all those things.
Right. Well, on Friday, as we call it, Black Friday, the NRC managers were still in Washington trying to control the accident. And basically what happened was the plant was periodically releasing radioactive gases, xenon primarily, essentially to keep the pump, the makeup pumps from tripping. But we had a state police helicopter right at the vent. We were told beforehand, and we had a state police helicopter at the vent taking readings right there. And those readings over, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday had been going down. Okay. And I think the last reading they got when they did a venting was 1,200 millirem per hour. Well, somebody, either an NRC guy in the control room or somebody down in Washington, made the mistake that was an offsite reading, not a reading directly in front of the vent. And based on that, the NRC, and probably it was Harold Denton that made that decision, called the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency and recommended a take cover, some emergency action. Now, our agency was the one that was supposed to be making that recommendation, and we totally disagreed. I mean, we knew what was going on, and we scurried to try to, you know, get that thing stopped, but unfortunately the sirens went off and the take cover evacuation notice was issued.
Well, listen, here's Governor Thornburg at the this is a few years later. He's talking about what he was considering when he was thinking about evacuation.
Our principal chore was determining whether or not it was necessary to carry out a full-scale evacuation of some 200,000 people in that area. And evacuations are not to be undertaken lightly, as we've learned.
Now, let me follow up with that. Harold Denton of the NRC talking about evacuation as well.
And it was the governor's decision to evacuate women and pregnant women and small children just as a precautionary measure, since everyone was so hyper that Friday morning. There was nothing unusual or basis for that decision. It was sort of a compromise between doing nothing and doing a full-scale evacuation. Based on what the facts were, once we got them, we would not have recommended an evacuation that morning. If there were to be an evacuation, the only time it should have occurred was Wednesday morning when the core was melting.
All right, so you heard those two statements. They were made years later after the accident by Governor Thornburgh and Harold Denton. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that, well, first of all, you have to understand how recommendation for evacuation of pregnant women and children came about. I was in the governor's office at the time it was made. We were talking to the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and, you know, batting back and forth information. And, you know, finally the chairman said, well, you know, I don't know, but if, I guess if I had a pregnant wife and child in the area, I'd probably want to get them out of there. And that was what really caused it. You know, what was funny was because there really wasn't a need for an evacuation at the time, we really struggled to determine what changed to allow them to people to come back in. It was really a struggle because nothing had changed.
Mm. So when Harold Denton said this was kind of a compromise, the governor, and I've heard Governor Thornburgh say this, he felt he had to do something.
Right.
And so was that the sense that you got being there in those conversations?
Well, you know, here's the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission telling him what he thinks ought to be done. I mean, he had no choice.
Mm. Let's take a phone call, and I will get to that in just a moment. We have some phone calls coming in. You know, you said that a few minutes ago about taking action. Tonight, by the way, and I'll use this opportunity to promote what we're doing tonight, we have a documentary, two documentaries on WYTF-TV, one looking back at the accident. This starts at 8 o'clock tonight. And then the second, looking at nuclear power today and what the public thinks about it and what's going to happen, nuclear power in the future. But one of the things that was said there is that we had someone who evacuated. There were, I think the young man was 11 at that time, but talked about being in school and the teacher coming in and closing the curtains, that this was a way to, you know, protect yourself from radiation. So tell me, would closing the curtains protect you from radiation?
Absolutely not.
No.
I mean, when they say shelter, being indoors does provide some protection, particularly for the noble gases. Because essentially noble gases just give you a direct exposure. There's no internal issues. So, you know, being inside a building will provide some shielding from that direct exposure.
Let's talk with Paul in Lemoyne. Paul, you're on the air. Hello, Paul?
Hello?
Oh, is this Francis?
Yes, it is.
Okay, Francis, go ahead.
Okay, I've had a question ever since, like, a day after the accident, because I was in a business in Wilmersdorf, and two of the women that were employed there were talking to each other, and the one said, my brother-in-law was on duty in the control room last night, and he said that they were not allowed to bring liquids into the control room, but that he had brought a cup of coffee, and he had spilled it on the control panel. And ever since that, I've been wondering, did that have any part in what was going on?
Well, this is the first time I've ever heard that, but
it was just kind of like a chance hearing of that conversation.
And you know, I would have heard it because I attended all of the hearings they had after after the accident, and you know, all of the operators in the control room at that time were grilled, you know, in a legal setting. Mm. But I never heard that caused any issues. What really was the issue with the control panel was that the indication for the stuck open relief valve was just the power to the valve. So when they looked at it, it looked like the valve had closed. There was no direct indication that the valve was still open.
Wow. Thank you very much for your call. Can you imagine that a spilled cup of coffee caused the nation's worst commercial nuclear accident? That almost sounds, I won't say too good to be true, it sounds like the stories of a movie or something like that. Okay, Bill, so the governor's talking about evacuation. One of the key memories for many people is the lack of communication, the confusion, the chaos. And you had a firsthand look at that, the information that was coming out of MedEd and eventually and going to the state as well. I mean, right. We at one point, Governor Thornburgh was very upset at one of the press conferences. Said, we too are very concerned about the lack of information or reliable information we are getting. Talk about that lack of communication.
Well, to some extent, that's true. I mean, we didn't have any external indications other than, you know, when we sent teams out to monitor for radiation. So we had to take the word of the utility. Now, in retrospect, you know, except for some of the press conferences they held, which were kind of, you know, in my opinion, I've watched them, and actually was there for one of them. There was a lot of misinformation, and I think at one point the state really didn't want to talk to MedEd in terms of the governor's office. But in retrospect, I think the folks in the control room that we were talking to were really trying to give us accurate information. It's just that they, particularly early on, they really didn't understand what had happened. But I think, you know, what was surprising to me was that the media's reaction. I think the local media did an excellent job of trying to get information and reporting accurately that information. But unfortunately, further away you got from the plant, you know, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, I've heard some stories. In fact, we have an email here from Kid that says, I was in Florida. My wife was in Washingtonville, Pennsylvania, 60 miles from the TMI site. I felt totally shaken by the national news reports of the event as it progressed. I called home to see how dire the situation was. We discussed where she should go to be safe. We had more conflicting stories that addressed the meltdown with authority and our state of existence that could be best described as ambivalent. The hydrogen bubble report created a state of panic with one report and somewhat of a reassuring feeling with the next report. We decided we were far enough away to wait it out. We were concerned for those living next door to the plant. I think that's a perfect example of what you're talking about. Another example, I spoke with Dick Hawksworth from WGAL-TV, who covered the event. He said that NBC, which GAL is an NBC affiliate, had reported something that was inaccurate, and that GAL had to come on after the NBC newscast and correct their own network because it was creating, I don't know if I'd say a sense of panic, but the information was incorrect and that they had to correct. I asked Dick, I said, have you ever done that before? He said, no, that was the only time that he knows of that that ever occurred. So again, another example, but why is that? Okay, the local media, as you said, did a good job with it. Why was it the national media blew the story?
Well, I guess, you know, not having any direct information, you know, media tends to sensationalize, as you're aware.
Some do,
yeah.
Not us.
Yeah. But the local media had a bigger stake in the issue, and I think that's why they were trying to report accurately.
There's so much to talk about, Bill Dornsife, and I want to thank you for being with us on this, the 40th anniversary of the accident in Three Mile Island. You think back on those days. What do you remember?
Well, I'll never forget what happened. I mean, when I'm old and I don't remember my wife or kid's name, I'll still remember what happened at TMI because it was obviously a life-changing experience. Mm.
Have you written about this?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. Where could someone find
it? About a month or two after the accident, because of all the misinformation and the real guilt that I felt about how we scared everybody, I wrote a paper that was presented at an American Nuclear Society symposium on what really happened from a state perspective. And people can find that on the wall that WITF has created on the Internet.
Thank you very much, Bill Dornsife. In 1979, Bill was the director of the Pennsylvania Bureau of Radiation Protection. As a trained nuclear engineer, Bill was responsible for all coordination between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. To commemorate the anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident, we heard from several people about media coverage and the legacy of TMI. want to turn now to the media coverage a little bit. Dave Sullenberger worked at a radio journalist at WHP Radio in Harrisburg 40 years ago, and you probably recognize his name. He went on to work as a TV reporter at WHP TV. Dave Sullenberger, you're now in Indiana. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, good morning. Good to be here.
So let's go back 40 years, Dave. What do you remember about, first of all, that first day of the TMI accident working in a newsroom?
Well, the biggest takeaway I remember from it is just the gross uncertainty. I don't think that there was no evidence that Dick Thornburg or Bill Scranton knew a whole lot more about nuclear power and radiation than we did as journalists or the public did. It was just the whole idea of what is this thing that suddenly we're supposed to be afraid of or concerned about. You know, you can see floodwaters, you can see smoke, you know, other disasters. You can kind of, but this radiation thing was a whole new concept for us in the newsroom, but also I think for the public officials who were trying to explain what was going on. It was just the idea of uncertainty. What are the facts? What are the radiation readings? Who did what when? And just trying to get a handle on that was very difficult the first couple of days.
And as a journalist, as you're covering this story, which is probably unlike any other that you had covered up until that time, as you said, not knowing as much as what even the governor did, the lieutenant governor, who was the head of PEMA, Bill Scranton, knew at the time, there was a lot of confusion then from information you were getting from Metropolitan Edison, which run the plant, General Public Utilities, which own the plant, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission a little bit later. But there was a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. Describe that as a journalist, and as you're trying to put stories together, something that your audience is really, really wants to know what's going on.
Well, all we had to rely on was the people, the government officials, the State Department of Environmental Resources. I'm not sure what they were called in that time, DPE or something. They had a couple people who were knowledgeable about radiation doses and how much was being measured a place. But we were really at the mercy of Jack Herbine and the Metropolitan Edison spokespeople, and since then it's been called a public relations disaster, in that they just did not have a really handle on exactly what was going on, what had happened. They were talking about radiation releases and whether they were going to continue, and they kept saying yes, they will continue. We've measured them. We don't think they're a problem. They even went so far as to say we think the plant's going to be back in operation very shortly. They had no idea of the extent of the damage at that time, and all we could do was rely on the government officials who were trying to sort it out and tell us what we knew at that time. But there was just a lot of questions and a lot of vague, nebulous kind of evaluations of what had happened and what was going to continue to happen, because at this point they did not. This is even before this hydrogen bubble was determined, was found. They didn't know how much radiation was going to be released into the air, and it was just a lot of having to rely on people who either could not explain it in plain language or just didn't know what was going on.
So, Dave, let me go back to you. Jack Herbine was the main spokesman the first few days. Did you, as a journalist, get a sense that what he was saying was hard to understand, hard for reporters to comprehend, even hard for the people who were in elected office to understand?
Oh, absolutely. He was, like you say, he was not a public relations trained speaker. He was he would talk about radiation doses and millirems, and at that point people did not know what the unit of measurement was. They would say it's the same as a chest X-ray or normal background readings. And the thing that concerned people earlier the most was how much radiation was released and what damage does it do to the human body. And he was very, very uncertain as to how much was being released and when it was going to continue to be released and whether they were measuring it at a certain place, where they were measuring it. And he got a lot of questions about that issue of how much radiation has been released and what's the effect of that. And that was not his area of expertise. So there was, it was a long time until they, actually only when Harold Denton showed up later on did someone come up who could really talk in plain language and compare and describe what was happening in language that journalists could understand and the public could understand.
Harold Denton from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who Governor Thornburg asked President Carter to send someone who could sort out all the chaos and all the overlapping stories and conflicting stories. And many people point to Harold Denton as really one of the heroes of this because he was able to put it in plain language and explain what was going on.
Yes, he was. He was very helpful, and he. I think if there's anyone who restored calm and some kind of sense of stability to the whole situation, it was Harold Denton from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
So, Dave, when you look back on that time period, what are your first thoughts? What do you think about?
Well, it was just that whole question of what is this stuff that's coming out of this plant. It was at the beginning. It was not so much what could happen in terms of explosion or meltdown. It was mostly just the effects of radiation. And we kept. You know, I think a lot of journalists were wondering: are we sacrificing our health in order to stay here and explain what was going on to the people? And we thought, well, if that's the case, that's certainly a noble cause. But it was just the whole notion of who Ernest Sternglass from the Union of Concerned Scientists was saying every dose of radiation is an overdose, and then Jack Herbine was saying this is the amount of radiation which we've monitored different places is not enough to cause harm. Mm. So you had these conflicting evaluations of what's the effect of the releases, which they acknowledged were happening and would continue to happen all week long.
Dave Sullenberger was with WHP Radio at the time in 1979, went on to work for WHP-TV. Hey, Dave, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You're in Indiana, but thank you very much for sharing your memories of Three Mile Island.
No problem. Thank you.
I want to bring in Eric Epstein now. Eric has probably been the most vocal voice related to TMI over the last 40 years. He's chair of the group TMI Alert. Eric, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here, man.
40 years later. Now, you actually weren't here. You were going to school when the accident itself occurred. But as I said, you probably have been out front on this issue more than anyone. Over the last 40 years, your thoughts on what occurred on March 28, 1979, and what has occurred since?
Well, I think it was a stunning moment in history. Nobody was really prepared for an accident of that magnitude. If folks recall, there was no 24/7, 365 news cycle. So information that was parsed out wound up being inaccurate and misleading by the company. We had a situation where the lieutenant governor on Thursday, March 29th, basically had to confess to the public that the information they were getting for the utility was unreliable. And I think what really kind of amped up the psychic background, terror in the background, was the fact that a lot of people forget this, the China Syndrome had just been released 3 weeks earlier. So we didn't really have environmental reporters, Ben, science reporters. So a lot of folks, in order to achieve some kind of baseline on nuclear power, actually went to see the movie The China Syndrome. And, I think it was a turning point in terms of how we discuss nuclear power, not only in this country, but around the world. Prior to that time, we all accepted nuclear as a somewhat magic panacea to our dependence on Arab oil. We just had two oil embargoes in the 70s. So information coming out was confused. People really didn't know how to interpret it. I think folks would acknowledge at the plant, as they've done after the accident, that essentially filters went off stack. Monitors became clogged. And Scott, we really didn't know how much radiation escaped. In fact, we didn't know the full condition of the core until 84. So, I would say it's an accident without an end. I mean, obviously, the bookend at the beginning was horrific, and in my mind, a form of psychological terror because people don't know if they're coming home. They don't know what they're running from. They don't know where they're going or how long they're going to stay. But on top of that, people, I think, have lost track of the fact that TMI-2 was not cleaned up. It was defueled. At the time the plant was built, there was no decommissioning funding. So for the last 40 years, we've been trying to have TMI-2 cleaned up. Now, the plant itself, it was built for $700 million, was 5 years behind schedule and 2.5 times over budget. we did agree to help bail out TMI 2 in 81 with when Governor Thornburg, if you recall, was the governor at the time to help defuel TMI 2. And then we got the bill for the cleanup of TMI 2, but the actual plant and the cost to clean up the plant is $1.2 billion. So, you know, if you look at where we were back then to where we are now, I think there's a larger information base. I think the community is better informed. Obviously, we're having a discussion about nuclear now and bailouts. So it's an issue that has interest within the community. But from a media perspective, up until 85 when the plant restarted, that's Unit 1, not Unit 2, TMI had a dedicated reporter at the Patriot. There was a story every day. We were at the point where weather conditions actually included radiation releases at TMI. So there's been a titanic shift about how focused we are on TMI, but I think there's intense interest in the future of nuclear power now as there was then.
Hmm. Eric Epstein is with TMI Alert. So much to talk about over the next month or so, Eric, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Scott, thanks for having me on. And by the way, drive safely. It looks like it's a little slick out there.
All right. Thank you very much. Eric, always with a little bit of extra advice there. But something that Eric did mention that we've received several emails during this program about, and that is the waste. Nuclear waste is still being stored on Three Mile Island. In the early days after the accident, a lot of the spent fuel and a lot of the waste was being shipped elsewhere. Richland, Washington was a favorite spot where it went. There was controversy at the time about actually how it would be transported, whether by rail, by trucks. But think about that. There's an accident on the road with a truck, a train that derails. Those were a lot of things that people were concerned about, and rightfully so. And you know, some of the trains that went through these towns, the towns that they went through, was like, hey, we don't want that coming through our town. So as a result, since 1985, at least, probably all waste at Three Mile Island has been stored there in on Three Mile Island, the island itself, as Eric said, in the middle of the Susquehanna River. And that is an issue that will have to be dealt with some way, whether it's TMI or any other nuclear plant across the country. Wanted to talk now with Beth Surface. She was known as Beth Wolf at the time in 1979. Beth Surface was a first grade teacher at Kunkel Elementary School in the Middletown School District. Ms. Surface, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Well, okay, take us back to 1979. I mentioned that you were a teacher at Kunkel Elementary School, first grade teacher. Tell me about the accident. What happened March 28th? What you noticed around school? You know, were students leaving? Just what happened at that time?
Well, the day started as a regular day. It was a beautiful, as other people have said, it was a beautiful sunny day. Fairly early in the morning, we started having parents coming in who, it was obvious their anxiety level was raised, and they knew very little about what was happening, but their husbands worked on the island and they had received calls from their husbands asking them to go and get the children and to leave the area. So as the day went on, we had many more children who were being picked up. We didn't have any answers for the children. We did the best we could. We knew that we had to keep them indoors, keep the windows closed. They weren't allowed out for recess. At one point, we were told that the children would probably be organized into groups and taken to Wilson High School in Reading area. We were told to try and call our families so that our families would know that we'd be going into the Reading area later in the day. So it was basically organized chaos. As one of your callers indicated, there was nothing to see, there was nothing to smell. So I think that that's what allowed the staff to realize maybe this isn't as bad as they're saying because we didn't see the threat. But my concern leaving that day was for my children, the way they had been picked up by parents who were very anxious. Other children saw the anxiety, and when we left that day, my biggest concern was, when would we be back together? What would these children remember from that day? how would I create closure for them and then move on?
All right. So the school classes were canceled for most of the schools in the area over the next week or so. I'm going to jump ahead.
There's a lot to jump ahead.
You know, we're missing during those 10 days. But I want to jump ahead because your class did something that was unique. The students came back to school. What did they do?
Well, we always gathered in a circle first thing in the morning. That was our tradition, and that's how our first day began. And it was really important to me. I can't stress that enough, that I could go back to that day and talk to them about, you know, how we left that day, where they went. I tried to keep it light, and not, you know, to make them fearful. I was really interested in knowing where they had been and to welcome them back to school and to the classroom. And the more they talked, the more I heard how Harold Denton was their hero. He was the gentleman who came and, in quotes, let the air out of the bubble. So as I listened to their memories of those 10 days and the things that they heard their parents talking about, it became clear that we should write a letter. In fact, they said we should write a letter to Mr. Denton. So we took a huge piece of experience paper and we began writing the letter, and then they all signed it and they did their own illustrations. And the interesting thing that Harold picked up on when he saw the letter was that with their names, they were drawing pictures of Easter bunnies and spring flowers. And he saw hope in that letter, and he wanted to meet the children. So that was our unique experience. When we were finished with the letter, I folded it, put it in a book bag of a child whose father worked on the island. I had no idea if the letter would actually ever reach Harold Denton, but indeed it did, and the rest was up to Harold.
So, okay, the rest is up to Harold. What did he do?
He tried to get in touch with us. Unfortunately, it was Easter weekend, and we had come back to school for a few days, and then we were off for the weekend for Easter. Simultaneously, all the major networks were attempting to be in touch with Harold so that they could do interviews with him, and he made the comment to someone that he wasn't interested in doing interviews, but if they could find the first grade teacher, he'd really appreciate it. Through contacts, friends of mine, someone at WGAL was able to contact me, and we then proceeded to set up a time when we could meet with Harold Denton. And over the course of the next month, all of my children had the opportunity to meet him, and what started out as a very anxious time for them ended up being a time of meeting a hero.
I mean, I don't know whether first graders think this way or not, but I mean, were there kids who thought, okay, this is the man that kind of saved my life? Or again, I don't know whether kids think that way or not.
I don't think that they thought in terms of dying. I really don't, because they were just 6 years old, 6 and 7 years old. What they knew was that he left the air out of the bubble. Now, what their understanding was of that bubble, I don't even know that they understood that, but they understood the anxiety of their parents. They understood the fact that they were taken from their homes, and one little boy who was being raised by his single mother, they went to a hotel, and it broke my heart to realize that he was in a hotel alone, away from his friends. This is what they understood of that time, that it was an unusual experience. They saw their parents in a different light, and they just wanted to go back to normal. And by Harold letting the air out of the bubble, they could begin to go back to normal. Mm.
Beth Surface was a first grade teacher at Kunkel Elementary School in Middletown at the time, Middletown School District. Great story, and we'll be hearing more about it over the next month or so. Ms. Surface, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to one of the top stories of 2019 on Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.